Well, this is from an article on the week of Thursday, February the 10th, 2000. It said this: many have the same dream, finding the six magical numbers that unlock the treasure known as the lottery. Then life would be good. Problems would vanish. There are even collective fantasies of what to buy and with whom to share this new instant wealth. Well, Billy Bob Harnell Jr. shared those common visions by common souls seeking the salvation of sudden fortune. And in June 1997, he found it. He sat in his easy chair one evening and he looked at the quick pick, his quick pick, and then the Sunday newspaper. And Harold studied the sequence of numbers again and again and began to realize the wildest of notions. He and his wife Barbara Jean had the only winning ticket to a Lotto Texas jackpot of $31 million. Imagine finding that out, sitting in your evening chair looking at the newspaper, realizing you've just won $31 million. Harnell, a deeply religious man, knew he had a godsend from heaven. After being laid off from a couple of jobs in the past few years, Billy Bob had been reduced to stocking the electrical supply shelves at a hardware store, and he was having a hard time providing for himself and his wife Barbara and his three teenage children. Every Wednesday and Saturday, those kids were on his mind when he scraped together a few spare dollars to purchase a lottery ticket. Well, he was in Austin with an entourage to collect his winnings, including his family, his minister, and his attorneys. The three most important people in your life, right? When you go, just to know, if you ever go collect $31 million, your family, your pastor, and your lawyer need to be there, just saying. Anyway, he showed up with this little entourage to collect the first of his 25 annual checks for $1.24 million. And this is the quote. He said, "Life has been tough. I didn't realize it would get this much better." And life did get better for a while. Harnell purchased a ranch. He bought half a dozen homes for himself and his family members. Not sure what he did for his pastor, but he and his wife and his kids got new cars. He made large contributions to his church. And if members of the congregation needed help, Billy Bob was there with the cash. Then suddenly, Harnell discovered that his life was unraveling as quickly as it had come together. His spending and his lending spiraled out of control. In February, those tensions splintered his marriage, and by May 22, 1999, 20 months after hitting lottery pay dirt, Harnell locked himself inside an upstairs bedroom of his fashionable home, stripped away his clothes, pressed a shotgun barrel against his chest, and fired. Billy Bob Harnell was gone forever. So was the fortune. And even the family that had rejoiced with him when the shower of riches had first rained upon him. A schism had widened between the children and the grandparents, and an intra-family war looms over the remnants of the fortune, which may now not even be enough to pay estate taxes. Shortly before his death, Harnell confided in his financial advisor, "Winning the lottery is the worst thing that has ever happened to me." Well, then most people on planet Earth really do think that winning the lottery and getting a lot of money would solve a lot of their problems, that the main issue in their life is that they're short of money and that if they just had some more, happiness would come. But King Solomon is about to disabuse us of that illusion. So turn in your Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes, if you just go to the other poetic books from the shortest name to the longest, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, that's how it goes. This is a book that's written kind of like the book of Proverbs, but it's more of a memoir. It's written by King Solomon. If you know Solomon, he was the son of David and Bathsheba, who survived and became king. And God appeared to him one night in a dream and said to him, "I will give you anything that you want." Talk about winning the lottery, right? And instead of asking for riches, instead of asking for long life and peace in his land, he asked for one thing. He asked God for wisdom. He said, "If I'm going to rule your people, I want to rule them in the way you want me to rule them, and so I need wisdom." And so God gave him wisdom and made him the wisest person ever to have lived on the planet. You can just imagine what that would do, double, tripling your IQ overnight and giving the wisdom, the spiritual wisdom of being able to use that. But not only that, God then also gave him wealth beyond measure. He was the richest person ever to have lived. He owned everything that his heart could desire. His nation became so prosperous during his reign, the only time Israel was that prosperous in a total peace. He was so prosperous that people in Israel, when they saw silver on the road, would not bend down to pick it up, the Bible tells us. It wasn't worth their effort to pick up silver, maybe gold, because everything was made out of gold. Everything was plated in gold. Gold streamed from all over the world to Israel. The entire temple was built and plated with gold. He was just that rich that absolutely anything that anyone wanted and needed in his country, he could supply. And you would think that this would make him happy. He also experimented then with many other things to try to make him happy. And the book of Ecclesiastes is really a catalog and a memoir, an autobiography of King Solomon, of all the different experiments that he used to attain happiness. And this included servants. He had servants waiting on him. I mean, imagine you had an army of staff to do absolutely everything you didn't want to do. He even experimented with alcohol, and that he tried to get the exact level of alcohol in his bloodstream to keep him, with his senses enough to carry on with life and rule the country, but just happy enough that he didn't worry about anything. And there's a chapter about that. He experimented with, and I know some of you have tried that too. Didn't work out for you either, did it? He experimented with building and architecture and art and landscaping, and he experimented with all sorts of different things. Music. He had a band walking around with him just to play whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted. We have that too. We call it an iPod. But in those days, that was new. Skip that song. Go to another one. Okay, and the band would play something else. I mean, he just tried absolutely everything. And of course, he tried women. Like no man has ever tried women. He married 1,000 women. Because, he had his concubines and he had his wives. And yeah, I'm sure that brought him a lot of happiness, having 1,000 women to take care of. But anyway, he experimented with all of that. And in the end, he said he felt empty. He felt empty, that life was absolutely worthless. And the book ends with him explaining where the only place to find true happiness is, and that is in relationship with the Lord. And so it's a wonderful book. It seems like a pretty depressing book as you're reading it. You always have to read through to chapter 12. If you're only reading one chapter, then skip and read chapter 12 afterwards as well, just to make sure that you round off his depressing musings through the book. But no book on people experimenting with happiness would be complete without a chapter on money. And so we find ourselves in chapter 5, chapter 5 of Ecclesiastes. And I'll pick it up from verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. That's a good line. Put on your wallet there. And whatever advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes. Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I've seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go out naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and to rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. So that's the section we're looking at this morning. Kind of philosophical language and poetic speaking. We're going to look at two sides of a slippery coin, so that you avoid frustration that money brings. If you've ever tried holding on to money that's slippery, you could see how frustrating that is. And we're going to look at he rebukes five foolish attitudes. And on the other side of the coin, we're going to look at how he encourages four wise attitudes. So you got your foolish attitudes towards money, and you have to understand how not to think about money first. And then he's going to tell us how to enjoy our wealth. Four ways to enjoy being rich. And you might think, oh, well, I can tune out because I'm not rich. That's what everybody thinks, and that's part of what he's going to teach you. Everybody thinks they could be a little bit richer. But if you have food and clothing, and you might even know where your next meal this afternoon is coming from, you're in the category, biblically speaking, of somebody who has all your needs met and more. And so we are all rich according to the biblical definition. And those of you who aren't, perhaps, and realize for sure that you're not rich, would you like to be? Probably. And so this book's going to help you realize maybe that's not such a good want after all. So let's first look at the five foolish attitudes. Number one, money will not satisfy. That's the first thing you have to disabuse yourself of. You have to realize this is a foolish attitude if you think money is going to satisfy. Look at verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. Okay, so friends, money itself is not evil. We have to understand that. Money itself is not evil. Jesus used money. Jesus collected money and spent it on his needs and the enjoyment of food and on the needs of the poor and all those types of things. Money itself is fine. But when a person sets their heart on riches that they have or riches that they don't have but wish they did, that's where the problem comes in. That's when you're setting yourself up for a tragedy. And the book of Ecclesiastes explains this in all sorts of areas, but especially in money. Now, this is the richest person in the world. And we know this, and the Rolling Stones even knew this, right? Mick Jagger, with all of his millions, sang the song that made him millions. I can't get no satisfaction. There you go. Can't get no satisfaction. And that's what that is really the byline of the whole book of Ecclesiastes, is no matter what you try, you cannot get satisfaction in this life without a relationship with the Lord. Now, trying to find happiness in money is like trying to quench your thirst with salt water. The more you drink, the fuller you feel, and yet the thirstier you are. People who are driven by greed and covetousness and discontent can never find joy. That can never be fed. It's like trying to feed a fire. And all the money is it's fueling the fire that keeps consuming it. God has designed our desires to long for Him and to be satisfied in nothing but Him. That's the point of the Genesis 3 curse. That's why God cursed the world, so that we wouldn't find fulfillment in work, that we wouldn't find our happiness and joy even in family and child rearing. That was cursed, so that we would find only our joy only in God alone. C.S. Lewis called money a less wild lover. A less wild lover. God is the one who should enthrall our passions and where we get all of our fulfillment from, and nothing else. And so we're designed to be satisfied in Jesus, and nothing else will work. And yet the suitor that is after our affections, that is the most persistent in this life, is money. It continually woos us with the promise of satisfaction, and we're built to operate like that. You know, companies know this. The people that sell us stuff know this. You know, you never read an advert saying, I know that you actually have everything you need, but if you ever want anything else, come and shop at our house, you know, at our shop. It doesn't say that. It always makes you feel like, you need this. You need that. You know, Nike has a policy that they never have the same shoe on a shelf for more than 6 months. They're always coming up with new shoes and new designs so that whatever you buy a half a year later will be out of fashion. And you'll feel like you need a new shoe, even though you just bought one from them, which they gave you. Now they're telling you, no, that one wasn't good enough. Well, why didn't you tell me that before I bought it? Well, they want you to buy the next one. Missionary Hudson Taylor said, the human heart has nothing that God cannot satisfy. Nothing that God can. There's no longing in you that can't be satisfied by God. And yet, very seldom do we look to God as the one to satisfy those longings. We look to His gifts instead of the giver Himself. And that's why St. Augustine said that the soul has a God-shaped void. And the book of Ecclesiastes really is a monument to that truth, that we have a God-shaped void that nothing else can plug into except our relationship with God through Jesus Christ. So that is the first foolish attitude that Solomon rebukes. If you're going to enjoy your wealth, you're going to enjoy your money, realize that it's not meant to satisfy you. And if you know that it's not meant to satisfy you, you are one step closer to actually being able to enjoy what God's given you. Secondly, the more you get, the more gets taken. That is a biblical principle. Look at verse 11. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes, you know, kind of watch it walk out the door. So the more you get, the more money you have, the more money gets taken from you. And if you know that and you go into that aware of that, then you realize that you're not going to be fulfilled by it, and you're one step closer to being able to enjoy it. If you won $31 million in the lottery and you realized that that meant that in a few years you would be in debt, maybe you wouldn't be so happy about winning the lottery. You say, well, how could I possibly lose $31 million in just a couple of years? This is the principle. The more you have, the more gets taken. You know about this. I remember very clearly the very first time I got a paycheck that got taxed. You know, my employer had told me this is what I was going to get. I was working as a teacher. I was a single man. It was a very big amount for somebody who didn't have anyone to support. And I was excited about how much I was going to have. And I think I might even have racked up some clothing accounts. You know, you have to look sharp when you're a teacher, I guess. And racked up some other accounts. And then I got my check, and the check was a lot smaller than what we had agreed. And that was the day I learned to hate tax collectors. But you got to do it, right? The more you make, the more gets taken. You know, if you're poor, if you're the poor one in your family, and there's going to be a family reunion, and they decide to go overseas, and they know that you're the poor one, then you're not even expected really to contribute to other people's tickets. If you can't come up with the money, maybe your family will even help you, right? But if you're the rich one in your family and you're having a family reunion, then not only are you expected to pay for your own ticket to get there, but you're also expected to contribute to the other people who can't, right? The more you have, the more gets taken. This is what he means when he says, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. There's no advantage to having more except that you get to watch more of it leave. And Solomon understood this better than anyone. In 1 Kings chapter 4, there's just this great little passage that says how much he spent in just running his household every day. 1 Kings 4:22 says that Solomon's provision for one day, because he had this massive staff, right? These people and the people that just lived in his palace to look after him. One day was 30 cores of fine flour. Well, that doesn't sound like a lot if you don't know what a core is. But picture this. That is the equivalent of 6,000 liters of flour. How many loaves of bread could you make with that? And 60 cores of meal. That's 12,000 liters of meal. 10 fat oxen. 10. Have you ever been to a spit braai with one lamb? Imagine an ox. Now imagine 10 every day. 20 pasture-fed cattle. 100 sheep. Besides the deer, the gazelles, the buck, the fat and fowl, for he had dominion over all the region. And it goes on to talk about how he had all these officers that were running his stable of 40,000 horses. 40,000 horses, that's a lot of food that they eat, and a lot of food that gets cleaned up after they eat it. You need an army of people to look after just your horses, right? And it just goes on. He understood this. The more money he had, the more got taken. When I was a student in seminary, I was dirt poor, and I didn't have to think about money much. Because I didn't have any, right? So I didn't pay tax. I made so little that the government didn't even tax me. This was when I was living in America. I didn't pay medical insurance. I didn't have savings accounts or credit cards or life insurance or investment policies or any of that stuff. My budget was very simple. If there was any money at the end of the month, I would spend it on whatever my heart desired, like a 99-cent cheeseburger or something, you know? And there usually wasn't even any money at the end of the month. But then I got a promotion. And I had a job that then paid for my tuition, and it paid me more of a salary, and this enabled me to get married. And then I started realizing, well, now I'm paying tax, and now because I can afford to get married, I did. And that comes with some expenses, I'm not sure if you've noticed. And now instead of cramming into a little place with five guys all paying a little bit of the rent, now it's just me needing to provide for me and my wife. And so suddenly I had more money, and yet I'd never had my 99-cent cheeseburger at the end of the month anymore. There was never any left, right? When you're renting, you don't have property tax and rates bills, and you don't even have house maintenance costs. But as soon as you own, I've got enough money to own a house, guess what? Now you're going to spend more. It's just the way it is. And if you know that, and you enter into your transactions realizing, if this is profitable, I'm going to lose more of it, then you're more content. You're closer to being happy with the wealth that God has given you. It's when that stuff catches you off guard that you get upset, right? Third principle, abundance breeds worry. You need to know this if you're going to enjoy wealth. Verse 12 says, sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. The laborer, the day laborer digging ditches, hard work makes you pass out. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. You have a clear conscience, you feel satisfied, you put in a good day's work, even if you're a little bit hungry when you go to bed, you're going to sleep fine. Why? Because you worked hard. But the rich person, he's so full of all of his abundance that he can't sleep, because the more money you have, the more ways you can lose it. And so the more you worry about that, and the more you have to plan and hedge against that, and the more you have to think carefully how to keep your money, and so you don't sleep as well as a laborer who doesn't even have enough food to fill his stomach, but at least he's tired from a good day's work. In fact, the Hebrew here says his fullness gives him no rest. If you've ever had like a really, really big meal where you just ate way more than you should, and you can't sleep because your stomach's just gurgling like a python trying to digest an elephant or something. You know, it's going to take a while. Well, this is like a metaphor. His fullness gives him no rest. Your fullness of your bank account, your fullness of your portfolio keeps you worried about it, right? Abundance breeds worry. Henry Ford started as a mechanic. When he invented the car and he mass-produced automobiles, he became wealthy beyond his wildest imagination. And he said this, "I was happier doing a mechanic's job." Not richer, happier. If I said to you, would you rather be happy or rich? A lot of you wouldn't be able to, that doesn't compute. In your mind, rich equals happy. Henry Ford said, no, I was happier before I was this rich. So abundance breeds worry. If you don't expect this, your life will become frustrating. Fourthly, easy come, easy go. Look at 13. Verse 13. There is a grievous evil that I've seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he's father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. So sometimes hanging on to your money actually hurts you. This is a grievous evil, he says. That a person actually has money, keeps his money, he hasn't even lost the money, and that hurts him. And then he does lose the money, and that hurts him, and he loses it at the worst possible time. It's just when he has his first son, just when he has a little baby boy, that's when all of his money disappears. And this is something you need to realize. Hanging on to your money can actually hurt you sometimes. People think of you as stingy. If you make it, you make more money than someone else in your family, they look at you as the stingy one because you're not giving them the money. And all you're doing is keeping your money. There's nothing wrong with that. Makes people resent you that you live in a nicer house than they do. Perhaps you feel guilty that you aren't giving enough money to the church. You never felt that way when you had nothing, right? Now that you've got more and more and more, and you know that your giving isn't really keeping up with how much God's blessing you, you start to feel guilty. This is what he says. Keeping your money can actually make you unhappy sometimes. And then trying to keep your money working, being a good steward of it, you put it into investments. But by definition, an investment is something that comes with risk. Comes with risk. And so because of that, every once in a while, your investment gets wiped out. And guess when that happens? Whenever is the worst possible time for that to happen is when it's going to happen. That's what he means when he says, those riches were lost in a bad venture. You know, you're supposed to be entering ventures when you have riches to look after that money, but the bad ventures, the risk kicks in and wipes it out. And when does it wipe it out? Well, when he's a father to a son, that's when he has nothing in his hand. Proverbs 23, verse 4 and 5 has this great image. It says, when you get wealth, it grows wings. That's one thing about money. Money is airborne. The more you have, the stronger the wings to carry it away from you. One of the millionaires in America's history, the Vanderbilt family, one of the members of the family said, the care of $200 million is enough to kill anyone, and there's no pleasure in it. The care of, the worry of, the burden of having $200 million is enough to kill anyone, and there's no pleasure in it. You're saying, Lord, I want that trial. I know everyone has trials. I want the trial of you robbing me of my pleasure by giving me $200 million. That's what Billy Bob thought, right? Fifth and finally, the last attitude that we're being rebuked of here is that you can't take it with you. If you want to be happy with your wealth, you have to have a mindset that reminds you that this is not something that's affecting your eternity. So keeping it doesn't help you. You can't take it with you. Look at verse 15. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil. and he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. People get frustrated when they treat their wealth like it's eternal. You try to treat your money like it's meant to last forever instead of be used up in the moment, it's going to frustrate you. That's like trying to breathe in enough air that you never have to breathe again. That is going to make you blue in the face. It's just not what it's meant for. God gives the money so that you can meet your needs and meet the needs of others and pass it on, and that's when he gives you more money. Like the people who were given manna in the wilderness, remember that? They were told, take enough manna just for one day. And what that takes is trust that God would give manna the next day. And the first day the manna came, and they were like, oh, this stuff's awesome, and they were eating the manna. They were like, what about tomorrow? So they hoarded some, and that manna was full of worms the next day. And God had to teach them, I will give you to use, and then I will give you again the next day. But when you try to keep it and hoard it up and think that this is going to last eternity, you're missing the whole point of it. And you get frustrated. Then when you're old and you're on your deathbed and you have all the money you need, you realize it can't give you what you want. You'll probably be the richest you'll ever be, the latest in life, you know, if you keep accumulating wealth. And that's when you will realize that no matter how much you've accumulated, it's not able to give you what you want at that moment. What you want is relationships. What you want is closeness with your friends and family. What you want is memories. You can't get that then. Doesn't matter how rich you are. What you want is health. What you want is more life. A lot of people say, well, the reason we don't eat healthy is because, you know, healthy food is very expensive. I don't want to go to the doctor because, you know, they charge me an arm and a leg to look at my arm and my leg, you know? And so, what are you spending your money on if it's not these things? When you're old, you're going to wish that you'd spend more money on your health, right? You're going to wish you'd spend more money on your diet so that you'd be healthier later. But people don't think that way. What you can take with you is your soul and your relationships with other believers. Nothing else matters. And one only usually realizes it's late in life, and then you feel like you've blown it. Money is a cold bedfellow on your deathbed. Okay, so that's all the depressing stuff. You're saying, I thought this sermon was entitled How to Enjoy Your Wealth. This makes me want to not be rich at all. Okay, well, that's a good start. It's helpful for you to realize that you will be frustrated with your wealth if you think that it's going to bring you happiness, and it's not. But there are ways of enjoying the wealth that God gives you. There are ways. And so let's look at the wise attitudes, four wise attitudes. Firstly, spend it on, this is how to enjoy wealth, if you have more money than you need, this is what you do. Spend it on experiences, not possessions. Look at verse 18. Behold what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink. Notice that. Now, you've probably heard the phrase, eat, drink, and be merry. This is where it comes from. Behold what I've seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil which one toils under the sun. Find enjoyment. Be merry. Eat, drink, and be merry. That is a biblical command. That's a good one, right? This is what I found to be good and fitting, to eat and drink, to enjoy your... Spend it on experiences, not on possessions. He's not saying, this is what I found is fitting and helps you, and this is what's good and fitting and with the wealth that God's given you, is just have a nicer car that's more comfortable to drive in. Yeah, those things are okay, but you know what really is? The experience. Have a meal with someone. Eat and drink. Spend it on things that cannot be taken away from you. Once you've had the experience, it can't be taken away from you. It's there. It's in your memory. You know, some really good friends of ours, Kim and I, many years ago, they took us to an expensive restaurant to bless us, you know, and we went and they said, you can only go on condition that you order all three courses and whatever you want, and don't look at the prices, you know. So it was just a blessing. We had this wonderful evening, and we had just, it was an exquisite meal. And then, you know, a couple of years later, they were back in town, and they said, hey, we want to go out for dinner. And we said, this time we want to bless you, and let's start a tradition that when we're together, we go back to this restaurant. So we went back to the same restaurant, and I just wanted to return the same favor, you know. Now, I had been obedient last time and not looked at the prices. and just enjoyed the meal. And I knew it was a pricey restaurant, but I figured, you know, shame. They spent their money on us. We're going to reciprocate. So we go to the restaurant. Now I'm looking at the prices very carefully because I'm the one paying. And in the meantime, the restaurant had gone from being one of the top 40 restaurants in South Africa to being one of the top 10 restaurants in South Africa. And so the prices had shifted as well. So now we're sitting in this restaurant. I'm looking at this. I mean, it was incredibly expensive. Just the four of us. I'm like, I'll have the salad and the water, please. Not the bottled water, the tap water, you know. And so we just ate, and I thought, just do it, you know, just bite the bullet. And when the bill came, it was literally half a month's groceries for our family. That's how much we spent on one night's meal. And it was a silent ride home that night between Kim and I, you know. But you know what? We still remember that night, and we still speak fondly of it. And I don't even remember how much it cost exactly, and who cares? We had a glorious evening. Now when they're in town, we go to McDonald's. We've had our memories. We're good. But you know, on my deathbed, I'm not going to remember the amount, but I will remember those friends, right? And this is what Solomon says. Spend it on experiences, not on possessions. It's the difference between spending your money on a new car or taking your kids in your old car on a holiday. It's those differences. On your deathbed, that's what you're going to remember, is the holiday, not the car. Secondly, enjoy the earning of it, not the storing of it. So firstly, spend it on experience and not possession. Secondly, enjoy the earning of the money, not the storing of the money. Look at verse 18. Excuse me. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in what? In all the toil, that's the work, in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Find enjoyment in the toil. The way you make money is you work for it, right? But if you are working and you hate your job, and you hate your career, and you hate everything about your life, except that you might say, well, why are you doing it? And your answer would usually be, well, I have bills to pay. You know, you've set yourself up in a house and a car and a holiday regime and a certain way of living that requires this terrible existence to pay for that. And Solomon's saying the secret to real happiness and enjoying your wealth is to rather enjoy the earning of it than the hoarding up of, wow, look how much we have in our retirement account. Look how much we have set up for the future. Let's tear down our barns and build bigger barns. Rather than do that and hate your life to get there, he says, earn less and enjoy what you do more. Now, just a footnote. Not everybody has this luxury. This is a blessing from God, and it's not a blessing everybody has. Some people have to work jobs that they don't like for whatever reason, whether it's an educational reason or a sociological reason or whatever, competency or that. But there are many people that God does give the blessing of being able to choose a career, being able to choose the path they're going to take, and they still choose one that they hate. And he says, that's a grievous evil. I have friends like this. I have friends like this from high school. When we graduated high school, my friends, they were like the smart kids, you know. I was always trying to keep up with them, and so they all went into these great professions. Most of them became chartered accountants, you know, and I studied a BA. And so there was always this joke that, you know, I'm either going to die, not being able to get a job, or I'll live and be happy, because the only thing I'm qualified for is stuff that I enjoy. And, you know, then God saved me and put me on a different course. But at the time, it was like, man, maybe I should become an accountant. And then I thought of just putting a stick in my eye every day would be more pleasurable than that. So anyway, I went the BA route. My friends became accountants. Some of them liked it, but some of them didn't. And they just did it for job security. And now, years later, I meet them, and I ask them, and I talk to them. So wow, you became an accountant. Wow, this is a nice house, and what a nice car and stuff. And do you love it? And I hate my job. I've hated it all these years. I hate every day. I hate everything about it. Why do you do it? Well, I've got bills to pay. You know, I'd rather be poor and pick a path that is enjoyable, you know, or than be uber wealthy, but pick a path that to get there is just soul numbing. Many of you are in that position right now. You hate your life, and you do it just for the money. Solomon says you're an idiot. He says, just get over that. This is your life, not the money. On your deathbed, you're not going to care about your portfolio. You're going to care about your memories. Do something about that. Just a footnote. Please don't quit any of your jobs till you get counsel. Okay, I understand. Okay, so that's it. Enjoy the earning of it, not the storing of it. In fact, in chapter 4, he also says it this way in verse 6. He says, better is a handful of quietness than two handfuls of toil and striving after the wind. You know, if you work very hard, you've got both your hands on your job, you'll make more money. And he says, you know what's better? Is one hand on your job and work hard, and one hand of quietness and relaxation. Work hard so that you have money to enjoy the money. Don't work hard so hard that you never have time to enjoy it. Thirdly, acknowledge that it's from God. This is very important. Firstly, if you're going to enjoy your wealth, spend it on experiences, not possessions. Secondly, enjoy the earning of it, not the storing of it. And thirdly, acknowledge that the wealth that is coming to you is from God. Look at verse 19. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. This is the gift of God. Think about what this verse is so packed with truth. One, God is the one that's given you wealth and possessions. So if you're feeling guilty about having wealth, don't feel guilty. God has given you that wealth. There's a caveat coming, but it's a gift from him. He's given you the wealth. He's given you the possessions. You have way more than someone else in the world. So even if you think, well, I'm not very wealthy, whatever you have, there's people with less than you. Trust me. I've seen it. And wherever you are, there's people with more than you. I've seen a lot of that too, right? But that doesn't matter. You need to realize that what God has given you is what he has given you, and it's a gift and it's a blessing. And you need to acknowledge that it's from him. This implies certain things, by the way. If this is something that's given by God, it implies that you're getting your wealth through honest means. You can't run shady business deals and say, look at how God's blessing my business. That's where Psalm 73 kicks in, and you're the guy who's fat from your wealth. It says that he's so fat that his eyes are bulging and his hair is dripping with oil. I guess that was a sign of being rich in those days, a lot of gel. And he's so fat, and when he dies, he goes to hell. That's Psalm 73. Because he's getting his wealth apart from God's blessing. But if you are running an honest business and you're working hard and you're doing the right thing and you're balancing family and work responsibilities and you're giving to the church and you're thanking God for you, enjoy your wealth. Enjoy it. It's a gift from him. It says this. This is the point. But notice also what it says. For also to whom, verse 19, for also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and the power to enjoy them. The ability to enjoy what God has given you is a gift from God. How many really, really rich unbelievers do you know that are really, truly happy in their money? Not many. Not many. Like what Henry Ford said. Like what Vanderbilt said. Like what Rockefeller said. Rockefeller said, I have made many millions and they have brought me no happiness. One of the richest people alive said that. You can't enjoy your wealth unless you have a relationship with God and he empowers you to do that. So if he does and you are in a relationship with him, then you can enjoy it. You can have a clear conscience. And if you can afford a nice car, buy a nice car and enjoy the nice car. But only if you can afford it. Truly afford it. You've got it by honest gains and you've been a good steward and you can afford it after you're doing the other things God wants you to do with your money. Support the local church. Help those who are in need. Be generous, not stingy. If you're doing all of that and you can still afford a nice car, enjoy the nice car. Give a ride to someone who doesn't have a car. Buy 3 cars so that you can lend them to people who don't have cars. Enjoy it. There's nothing wrong with that. If you're getting it honestly and you're worshiping God with it and you're doing all the other things that you're supposed to be doing, this is sometimes left over. God blesses some people that way. So acknowledge that it's from God. How do you use God's other gifts that he gives you? Your talents, your education, your relationships. Well, you share them. You use them for the gospel. You help others. You rely on his grace. Just do that with the money that he gives you. Share it. Use it for the gospel. Help others. Rely on his grace. Maybe if you feel guilty about your money, it's because you are guilty. Because you're not using it the way you should be using it. But a person who is using the gifts of wealth to give God glory can enjoy the leftovers with a clear conscience. 1 Timothy 6:17 says this. This is an instruction Paul gave the young pastor Timothy to tell the rich people in his church. So that's you. As for the rich in this present age, I love how Paul calls us rich in this present age, you know, because it means nothing in eternity. But as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty. Don't think that your money makes you anything grand. Not to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches. Don't put your faith in money, but on God. And then he says this, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. Why does he provide it to you? Why does he give it to you? And you might think, I don't know why I have as much as I do. I don't know why I have more than other people do. I don't know why. This is why. Because it's a blessing from God. He's given it to you to enjoy. Bearing in mind that you're using it as a wise steward, getting it in the right way, sharing it, using it for the gospel work. And if you're doing those things, by the way, you're losing money because you're honest at work. That happens. And you're sharing your money and you're supporting others and you're doing what you should do, you might not have any leftovers. Well, that's fine too. Better that you use the money in a wise way and you have a clear conscience in the relationship with the Lord and you can enjoy the blessings that he gives you, then you know that you should be giving more, but you're keeping more to yourself because you want this or that. There's nothing like a clear conscience. And then fourthly and finally, pursue biblical contentment. This is how to enjoy your wealth. Verse 20, for he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. You're not going to worry about the misery in life, and Ecclesiastes reminds us that life is about misery. You're not going to worry about that stuff if God occupies you with joy in your heart. What is the goal? What is everybody's highest desire? It's to glorify God and enjoy him forever. As Christians, we know that. But even unbelievers, their highest goal, any unbeliever's highest goal, whatever you ask them, it's actually joy. I mean, they might say, well, I want a new car. Why? So I can go faster and sit more comfortably and impress my friends. Why? Because that'll make me happy is going to be at the end of that. Why do you want a new house? Why do you want a new this? Why do you want that? Why do you want to go overseas? Why do you want better clothes? Why do you want a big retirement? Well, so that I can feel safe in the future. Why? So blah, 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 blah. It'll end up with to be happy. And the book of Ecclesiastes tells us that's not how happiness comes. Happiness doesn't come through those things. You're going to be chasing after the wind. It's like a hunter who's stalking the wind. He's never going to get that thing. It's always going to be a step ahead of him. 1 Timothy reminds us of this in chapter 6, verse 6. Now there's great gain in godliness with contentment. For we brought nothing into the world, we can take nothing out of the world, but if we have food and clothing with these, we will be content. Contentment. Contentment is being happy with what you have. Being content, not wanting more. Paul said, I've learned to be content with plenty, when in hunger and in plenty. I forget the verse. Yeah, he was happy when he was poor and when he was rich, is what he meant, right? And he was saying that from prison. I have memorized it. It's in there somewhere. So if you pursue biblical contentment, you'll have that joy. You'll go straight to the prize without having to bump your head against all this folly on the way. Proverbs 30 verse 8 says, give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that's needful for me, what I actually need, lest I be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. He says, this is a great prayer. You want to pray a prayer over your financial portfolio? This is what you should pray. God, don't make me too rich. And don't make me too poor. I want to have my needs met so that I'm not tempted to steal. You got to be pretty, pretty poor to be tempted to steal your bread. So you want a little bit more than that. You've got enough for food for your family. But you don't want to be so rich that you deny God. And you might say, well, I'll never deny God. Yeah, but you start denying him in your actions. Let me ask you this. Why do you think you're going to be fine in your retirement? Oh, well, because I've been putting a little bit aside since I was 20. And compounding interest, and I've got this great retirement package that's going to pay out. See, you're denying God. That is not going to look after you in your retirement. You know who is? God. If you say, well, the reason I feel safe about the next 5 to 10 years is because I've got all my finances sorted out, I'm going to be able to pay for the kids' school fees, and I've got my health policies, and I've got my insurance stuff, I'm going to be safe. You're denying God. Now, I'm not saying get rid of that stuff. You need to be wise, but don't put your heart on it. Don't put your faith in it. Put your faith in God. He's the one. Don't deny him. The key to enjoying wealth is to see it as a bonus, not as a need. What you need is nutrition and enough covering to keep you safe from the elements. Everything else is a bonus. And most of the world lives below the poverty line. Most of the world survives on less than you and I spend on grooming. I mean, our hair product budget is more than their food budget, often. Some of us. I wasn't looking at the bald people. You guys are doing good. Most of the world lives below the poverty line. Our job is to just get some perspective. Get some perspective when we think we need something. Do you really need that? Think of what you're spending your money on. Do you really need that? And now this is, as I close, I'm just going to give one final little rant. And the Cornerstone group's proud of me for making it this far, for not getting there yet. What is my pet peeve in life, someone from Cornerstone? Debt, that's right. Okay, and why? Because this is what Solomon's saying. If you want to learn to be content, that means you have to be content with what God has given you now. Not what you hope he's going to get you in the future and you want now. And a credit card is a rash debt. It's a rash vow. A credit card is saying, I want something that I don't have now. God hasn't given me now. He hasn't seen it's fit to get, but I want it. You're like a 3-year-old. I want it. I want it now. And so you swipe it. You go into your rash vow. You get it. And now, a few months later, there's a need in the church, or there's a need that you believe in your heart you should meet, but you can't. Why? Because you don't have the money. Why? Because you have to pay back your credit card debt. And so you get yourself into debt. Debt, friends, debt is very, very destructive. I've seen debt ruin marriages. I've seen debt ruin families. I've seen debt ruin people. It is a corruption, and our society gives it away like candy. You need to resist it. It is, if you've ever gone into debt for something, you're saying, I'm not content with what God's given me. I want something else. I want more. And now he needs to provide for me so that I can pay that off, to the point that now you don't have money to give the other things that you need. And you're saying, wow, did you buy your house cash? No. I didn't buy my house cash. There's a different debt is when you can't pay it off. You know, if you put down a big enough deposit on anything, then it's not really debt if you can sell that to clear it, right? I mean, if I say, oh, Charles, can you spot me $5? I'm $5 short for my burger. Charles knows I'm good for it, you know? He knows he's going to get his money back. I can go and there's something at home that's worth $5. But if I say, hey, friend, can you just spot me $50 million? That's debt, because there's nothing I can do to clear that off, right, to give it to him. So you just need to be wise with your money. Please get counsel if you're in debt. We love helping people get out of debt in our church. Our church is debt-free at the moment as well. We also had assets that outweighed our loans. Don't think we're being hypocritical with that. I'm just saying, be content with what you have. Be wise with what God gives you. So, let me give you an example in conclusion of Lady Selina Hastings. She was the Countess Huntington. She's known as the Countess Huntington in biographies of some famous preachers from the 1700s. And this is what she used to do. She was immensely wealthy, and she was a believer. And so what she would do is she would use her wealth to throw these massive banquets and invite all the top politicians and all the rich people around in Britain to come to her house. And they would have these like tons of royal family people there, and politicians and influential people. And then she would invite George Whitefield. And once she had everyone sitting down and she had fed them all this great food and everyone was so grateful, she'd say, now I have my friend George who's going to come tell you something. And George Whitefield would preach to them for an hour and a half, the gospel. And she did this often, and people just couldn't resist how good the food was. So they'd come and they'd hear George Whitefield preaching the gospel at them. You know, that's just one way of acknowledging that the wealth that God's given you can be used while you enjoy it and to bless others, but at the same time to give Christ glory. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we do thank you for your word, and we do thank you for this challenge. We thank you for your many gifts, Lord. We just pray that we would never fall in love with the gifts, and that we would always be in love with the giver. We thank you for the ultimate gift of sending your Son to die for us on the cross, that we could be cleansed of our sins by simply putting our faith in him. Lord, absolutely everything that we have is from you, and everything that we have is more than we deserve, but it was earned for us by Christ. And so we thank you for his sacrifice in Jesus' name.